as an industry, as a market, as a place of creative experimentation, and how much depth exists in the space. I think it's one of the most exciting food and drink trends that will be coming out of India for the next at least 15 to 20 years.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to another episode of the Indian Dream Podcast. I'm really excited for this episode where we interview Vidur Gupta from Stranger & Sons, a brand of craft gin. This episode is a continuation of our deep dive into the trend of craft alcohol in India. You should listen to our previous episode with Brewvale about the craft beer scene in India. I'm not going to lie, gin and tonic has recently become my favorite drink after beer. I was first introduced to Stranger & Sons as a birthday gift and I fell in love with it. But I did not believe my friend when they told me it was an Indian brand. The packaging was so modern, the taste was so good, and I just didn't think that Indian brands were making such high quality spirits, especially gin. Stranger & Sons has broken that mold. In this episode, we have a fascinating discussion with Vidur on how they thought about building a gin brand, the entire process of getting the precise flavor profile they wanted, and how they market the brand. We even speak about nerdy stuff like alcohol licenses, working capital, and distribution, for those of you who want to know more about the business side of building an alcohol brand in India. If you're interested in building a new business, you should read our latest newsletter, 21 Awesome Business Ideas for 2021. It's a great way to start off the new year. The link is in the show notes.
So thank you so much for joining us today, Vidur. Thank you so much for taking time out. Really excited to have the conversation around how did you come up with the idea of Stranger & Sons, and really understand, you know, the craft spirits industry in this country. So first question to you, how did you land up at the idea of Stranger & Sons creating a craft gin? What was the journey like to land up there?
Awesome. So I've always been involved with the food and drink space. I think, you know, very early on, even while I was studying economics, a lot of my ideas were around making the food space either more sustainable or the supply chain slightly more viable. Till my first job was actually running impact investing for a food-based multinational, to then coming to India and starting my own sort of packaged food brand called Gauri's Goodies, which was my first sort of stint at being entrepreneurial for that matter. And I think the whole concept is, at that point also we had this India proud kind of wave, in the sense that India was finally waking up to the fact that we actually grow and make almost everything here, which is of pretty good quality. You know, this obsession with the West and Western food ideals was slowly starting to die. You had the advent of, you know, Hokey Pokey, which basically became Epigamia, you know, the brands like Raw Pressery that were really championing the fact that, you know, we can make stuff from here, which is as good as anything that you can buy from any other country. That being said, so when I was studying in the UK, and Sakshi, my business partner and cousin, was studying in Spain, we noticed that a lot of the Indian narrative in alcohol was definitely being borrowed. So, you know, botanicals coming from here, the stories of gin and tonics from here, all of those stories, run-of-the-mill stories that we are getting, at least being in the gin space, tired of hearing. This whole exposure to gin in India was really being exploited in the West. And funnily enough, you know, the space here, when we started talking about it in early 2016, at least late 15, early 16, when Sakshi was in impact investing too, our third partner Rahul, who's now Sakshi and Rahul are married, and so it's a small little family business, also had you know, experience with Gateway Brewing, and so we knew distribution, we knew manufacturing. We knew finances, we knew back end, we've all sort of run businesses before. And the idea there was then, you know, when we were looking at even buying alcohol for ourselves in India, we saw that there was a price gap. There was no one really talking about the India story, where everybody's talking about botanicals coming from all over the place. And that the space in quality distilling was not really being supported. Whether you know, we are one of the largest consumers of liquor in the world, but it's really, we're known for this like mass production of liquor constantly, and that also troubled us because we were basically had all the ingredients and including the market to make something that was, you know, quality specific or whatever, craft specific for people to actually get into it and care about what they're making and stand on the 2 feet that it's been constructed completely in here, in India, I mean. So I think that was the base journey to Stranger and Sons. I think when we started, we are a Punjabi family, so very often we said, okay, you know, we'll put in a still, and if nothing else, the family will only drink it up. We'll see what will happen after that. And you know, the kind of traction we received was jarring at some point. You know, we ran out of stock in our first 2 months, which we started trying to refill that stock. Stills got larger. We started rejigging how you know, all of us were doing different things. And then we decided to jump ship full on here because I think as an industry, as a market, as a place of creative experimentation and how much depth exists in the space, I think it's one of the most exciting food and drink trends that will be coming out of India for the next at least 15 to 20 years.
I completely get the idea of the India narrative building and saying that, hey, you know, why are we consuming all the products that are basically marketed by Western companies and are crafted for probably the Western taste, right? And those were the ones that were coming into India. Few years back, I think 10 years back is when we saw this happen with beer. And Rahul, as you said, one of your co-founders actually started one of the first microbreweries in India called the Gateway Brewing Company, right? My question to you here is, beyond the India narrative, India has been a beer or a whiskey market primarily, right? So for you to say that gin is what we wanted to do, did you have a unique market insight in terms of gin picking up, or that was something that was being adopted? What was the insight there?
There's two things. One was, you know, I used to work with the UK Trade and Development a lot, and we basically realized that India is relatively 5 to 6 years away from any sort of major food trend that comes out of the West, namely America and Europe. And we are, as an English-speaking country, will mimic that pretty quickly, whether it was biscuits or fruit juices or fad diets or, you know, whatever. Gin, obviously, the Renaissance, whatever, that started in Spain, you know, it was about three years since that had happened, 2013-14. When we were looking at it. So the idea was that, yeah, we'll have to hold out a little bit, but there is a good chance that's coming to India. Then the next argument that you get a lot when it comes to gin specifically, just to clear this out before that, we started something called Third Eye Distilleries. Third Eye Distilleries is a distillery that bases itself on premium and provenance. So we are hell-bent on basically showing the world and India the fact that we can make really good, high-quality spirits. Stranger and Sons is one of those brands. And then there was the second argument that, oh, only like less than 0.1% of, you know, drinks gin in India, such a large whiskey market, of which, you know, a lot of it at that point was all this brand called Blue Ribbon. And at the moment, the idea was that, okay, you know, where's the opportunity? There's two ways of, again, looking at that. If something's 1% of the market and it has forces to grow, that means you still have then 99% of the market to try and break into, right? Other than the fact that it stayed 1%. You have to understand all food trends, if you look at market history, are cyclical. You know, if you talk to our grandparents, they were all drinking vodka martinis. You know, Smirnoff came in and did that. Now, no one's drinking any vodka anymore. You know, Grey Goose, you'll remember brands like Grey Goose and Stolichnaya were like the biggest things you found in bars 10 years ago. The idea is that with anything, whether it's food trends, food in general is cyclical. And so we anticipated that the gin cycle was going to break. And the third was just logic and I think a certain sense of personal pain. And, you know, you couldn't get a good gin at a decent price anywhere in this country. If you had to, it was a serious situation. Everyone at all these events was drinking whiskey all the time. And, you know, I'd spent, I think, 6 or 7 years in Europe by then. It took me a while to acclimatize here, but the last thing I want to have a whiskey in a hot country, you know, you're just like, this is starting to make little sense. The other one was beer, then beer became this almost less fun sort of bloaty thing. So for us, we were just like, but a gin makes perfect sense here because you can make, you know, put a gin tonic, lots of ice. You've got a nice freezing cold drink, which is far more fun and exciting and can do much more with it. So I think those were the three things in terms of market that we were just like, it makes sense. And then between the international and national players, there was actually nobody in that sort of price gap, which is a very large price gap when it comes to pricing, which is why you can see that so many newer players have come over the last couple of years and they've all found themselves a space in the market. It's just because the market is that big. It's not that the market is getting more crowded.
So, Vidur, you know, I just want to take two things that you said and like combine them together. One thing you said that there was a big gap in the market of a good quality Indian gin, and especially in that price gap. And the second thing you said is that when you first launched, all of your gin was sold out in less than 2 months. So I think what there was that there was a big demand that was not being met. And then suddenly Strange & Sons or Third Eye Distillery just came in and met that demand. And therefore you had that instant, what they call a product market fit. But one question that I had that I was just wondering while you were talking about this is that how do you scale demand for something that requires maybe several months or several weeks to distill? I assume gin has a slightly long distilling process. Correct me if I'm wrong about this.
No, so it depends on how you make your gin. We actually make our gin in what some would argue is the most painstakingly long way to do it. We do something called single shot distilling. So we have Dutch distilling equipment, which is some of the best in the world. Single shot gin basically means that you put all of the fresh botanicals in each time that you do it. And it's about a 16-hour process to get the raw alcohol out, and then you dilute it down. We rest it for 5 weeks, which is the longest time you can rest gin. Anything longer than that makes no sense. Just because we're so close to Indian botanicals, you know, how many people can say in the rest of the world that I can drive across the road and go and talk to my pepper farmer and understand what pepper I'm picking up? And, you know, the idea is when we made our first few batches of gin and the first recipes that we had designed, this was the first time we had actually then basically was so close to source and had got all of these botanicals while we were doing all these experiments in Europe. And the flavor was completely different, you know, much stronger. People don't even know that. I think very often we assume that distilling recipes all come from cold countries, so they require maceration times. You know, you have to understand the table water here is coming out pretty warm, and had to adjust a lot of our distilling methods to understanding the region, in a region which high quality distilling hasn't been done in a long time. This is one of the longer ways to distill gin, but gin doesn't need any aging unless you make barrel aged gins. So anything, whether you distill a whiskey or a vodka or a this thing, the base process of distilling usually remains the same. A multi-shot process is what larger brands use. It's basically while you create a flavored, almost like a bouquet spirit of sorts, and then you like drive down alcohol and water to increase it. So that's the more sort of mass production of it. We will obviously hold on to our single shot distilling because that's the whole point. It's the aging process that takes time. A whiskey needs years in the barrel. Darker rums need years in the barrels. But everything else is all about the kind of process you choose, the kind of equipment you choose, and then how far are you, you know, what kind of ingredients you use, and then how far are you willing to go to hold out cost to quality in getting it absolutely right.
So I have two questions over here. The first one is quite simple. So from what I understand, what you guys are doing, what the single shot distilling, that, if I understand correctly, is the more craft way of making the gin, while the multi-shot would be the more commercial way of making the gin. And secondly, just generally, what is the process of making gin?
Okay. So a gin is basically a rectified spirit. So it's basically any base spirit that has to be distilled once with juniper berries. Permutations and computations of gin are endless, especially in a place like India. Like, the idea in India is not like what can we put in. The idea in India becomes what can you take out. You know, you have like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ingredients. Like, people are chucking flowers at you and herbs at you and things from an Ayurveda shop you never heard before, and you know, the teams we're all in the start getting super excited, yes, tasting left, right and center, and that leads to fun evenings, and all of that was great. But the idea was to narrow that down. So and what are you going to use to do that, and how is it going to age in the process and stuff like that. So that's basically it. So gin is any base spirit. So you can make a base spirit out of anything, you know, wheat and barley, fruits, whatever you like, and then distill that once with juniper berries, and then you can add whatever else. But without juniper berries in that spirit, it's not called gin. And that's really it. It actually looks more mysterious than it sounds always. Everything with alcohol.
So I actually want to go down a little bit on the entire product development side of it, because I'm sure that was not an easy task. So Rahul, like you mentioned, has some experience with
craft beer.
With craft beer. While it is very different from craft spirit, he had some experience there, and you have experience from the food space. So how exactly did you guys do the product development? Like you said, a lot of fun evenings. I'm assuming that they must be very fun evenings. How did you guys go down that road?
That's what I said. I think Rahul Sakshi and I, the one thing we have in common is that we really love, we're actually just passionate about food and drink. You know, you'll see any excess money that we'll ever make in our lives will go into getting to a good restaurant or buying decent ingredients. Or like, you know, none of us care about clothes, shoes. Like, this is it. This is our life. It's like, and we've been like that since before we got into food and drink ourselves. Maybe me and Rahul got in slightly earlier. But, you know, Sakshi herself also is really, really clued into the world just because it's our natural interest. So we have a good understanding about flavor. We also had good understandings between us. You know, Sakshi had some very good sort of logistics experience, and how, you know, that's why we're so much better at sending our stuff all across the world at the moment. You know, we knew what it was like to get food grade equipment in. What is the difference? The three of us went to the Netherlands also and studied how to distill. We also then went and studied how to use the machines ourselves, so we can actually step in for our master distiller at any point, or head distiller at any point at this time. And we actually built, created, and produced the first recipe ourselves. I was like, literally, we used to sleep. We had this, like, we built this water cooling machine by some engineers in India, which basically allows us to save some water and basically cools the water slightly faster, and allows us a huge saving in water, just to, you know, because we wanted to put our impact investing experience into everything that we do at Stranger and Sons. That machine at one point was not cooling my still fast enough, and we couldn't recognize that that was a problem. So we had to hit restart on the button basically every couple of hours when this thing would start beeping like a maniac. And, you know, these guys in the Netherlands would just wake up the next morning. So me and, you know, or someone from the team, at that time the team was just four of us. It was three of us, and we had one more guy with us at the distillery, Prajot, who's still with us. And we would, without a fan, nothing, there was nothing except for this nonchalant looking thing in the corner of the room. And we would literally sleep there because there was no other way of knowing whether this thing is going to beep or not. And we spent our first few rounds, just that batch one, just building it like that. So it's like a full on, like, even when we set up the still between me and Sakshi, we actually built it ourselves. And there was someone, you know, at for whatever reason, we were not allowed any forklifts. So we would actually we had to create a human chain of people to take it from ladder to ladder to finally get that height and put it up.
Why weren't you allowed forklifts? Like, is there some sort of regulation
around it? Yeah, at that time, I think for whatever reason, we were not getting to a forklift and or the facility, this, that, and the other. So, because it's in the backs of beyonds of Goa, right? So it doesn't come easily. Then we didn't have time, you had to get up and running. So the idea was just like, okay, let's get on with it. Can we get six men? Can we look at some pictures from how they built pyramids in ancient Egypt and try it? We basically rolled them over logs, like the same way, man. It's like,
oh my God,
get back to the basics. Yeah.
That's pretty crazy. So the reason I'd asked this question also was that to understand what kind of skills people need in order, if they want to get into this industry, if they want to get into any food based industry. And obviously what you said makes complete sense. You need to have that passion for food, you need to have that palate that can understand flavor profiles.
Yeah, so I think when it comes to, I think your older question was when it came to recipe building and understanding flavor, the idea is to really break up the palate for us. So I know I'm answering a little bit of your earlier question, and we did that by you know, understanding very clearly in alcohol what happens on your nose and what happens at the back of your throat. And there's something, this concept of a one-dimensional or a three-dimensional gin. And when we were creating the recipe, we had a couple of recipes in mind, one which was like a classic London Dry gin, which would have done very well in a gin and tonic, and one which is the current Stranger and Sons that we had built quite meticulously, which stood out. It was a little bold. But something that we thought you wouldn't forget. And if we are going to say that India is going to stand on its first time, like really showcasing its botanicals, then let's bring that out. So we boil down from that concept into then it has to be a three-dimensional gin, because Stranger and Sons, the whole concept of the brand was to celebrate our eccentricity. So I'll tell you why the name Stranger and Sons, so it'll make sense. Stranger because, you know, India is a wonderfully strange place. It's full of these stories, customs, and this movement of culture that only exists here. And we have all these stories in different states that are only based on us. And that's very rare. I tell a lot of people that, you know, if I started a brand in Iceland, I might have run out of content in 1 year. But, you know, now I have content for a millennia, and we wanted to find a way to accentuate that. Simple things like hiding shoes at a wedding, right? It's, for us, it's pretty normal. Tell somebody on the outside, they'll be like, what is going on? You know, and you have this like really warm stories, you know, the whole idea. That was what we wanted based on. And the and Sons bit is because it's me, Sakshi, and Rahul. It's a family business. So Gupta and Sons, Mehra and Sons, you know, Stranger and Sons. And so we'll always bring that Indian twang back to it. But we also realize that as an Indian family business, we in India always pass down stories from generation to generation. Unlike Europe, we didn't have these like written books. And, you know, even now, families will still transfer the transition to the next generation through a story, but won't write a will, you know, like things you hear about in India all the time. It was that idea of storytelling that based ourselves on this three-eyed, two-tailed mythical being with one hand and one paw. And the idea is that we have all these stories here, but can we have some fun with it, right? Can we run with it in this form of a satire that would be cool to somebody in Delhi and be as cool to somebody in London? The whole idea was to start a global brand from the get-go, which means if Bombay Sapphire can be looked at the same way globally, then why can't Stranger and Sons? And that was kind of the questions we asked ourselves. And that philosophy that, you know, Third Eye Distillery, Premium and Providence, Stranger and Sons, you know, this three-eyed mythical being who'd like run around, he'd fight with the mongoose and find juniper berries, and he'll like run around, you know, she'll run around, swim through a river, and we have all these stories coming up. And build that kind of complex world of India, our world of India, this contemporary world. India is no more BBC, 1940s BBC India, that India is young contemporary country that is doing so much, the youngest country in the world with some of the largest economic numbers. There is a side of us with arts and food and everything that's growing, and I don't think that got enough attention. And I think that's the attention that Indians and people abroad have loved to learn about. So coming back, taking this back to your recipe conversation, it was then how do you embody that idea in what you choose and what you don't? So, you know, we have this citrus peel mix that we finally boil down to that uses a Gondaraj lime from the east, a Nimbu, which all of us know, a Nagpur orange, and our Mosambis. And it basically, you know, we started to take these concepts and say this was sweet, zingy, sharp, all. And when you basically open the bottle of Stranger and Sons, it gives you this very strong aromatic nose, which is a lot to do with the hustle. Like, India is hustle and bustle, like it's order and chaos, right? And to get more philosophical about it, that's how we started thinking about our recipe. And that's what things worked for us, didn't work for us. Like should we put the nutmeg and the mace? The idea was that, you know, in India, we have this amazing culture of which we've also embodied of not actually throwing away anything. We use it, we pickle it, we cordial it, we do something or the other with it. And so nutmeg, the mace is basically the outer membrane of the nutmeg. And the mace added a beautiful layer of complexity to the gin as well. So I think it gets chosen as much from flavor than as much from what you personally want to portray, because gin can get really geeky like coffee, and it eventually becomes your expression about it, which it has. And then we stand behind that in a very personal level.
So Vidur, I mean, this was fascinating to listen to, and you're a great storyteller. I was enthralled the entire time. But what you said, one thing that really stuck with me was your description of the taste, how you guys went about with tasting, you know, with the one-dimensional taste, the three-dimensional taste, and all of that. And it reminds me of a story of One time I got stuck in Hong Kong overnight on a flight. And I knew a friend in Hong Kong, and he took me to some really fancy rooftop bar, and he bought me some gin and tonic. And the tonic was like, you know, from an Alaskan glacial melt, and like the gin was again some fancy thing. Yeah. And I drank it. And if you asked me to describe it, I would be like, oh yeah, it was good gin and tonic. But now listening to the way you talk about gin and tonic and how that was the most expensive gin and tonic I've had in my life. But I have no way of describing it the way you just describe your gin and tonic.
That's what I mean, right? Like, if you, the idea is that India itself is quite a hard-hitting concept. So you might as well make a gin that when you taste it, you're not going to kind of forget it. For example, like this year, we got selected. There's something called the Craft Gin Club in the UK. It's the largest gin subscription service in the world. And so in one month, they select 12 gins a year, and you go through this like rigorous, like 8-step tasting process and all this jazz. But basically it's going to 100,000 homes. They're going to place an order for 100,000 bottles going to 100,000 homes. For a capacity like ours, even to shoot that out is daunting enough, let alone try and go for it. But it was this concept that they really liked. Right, that you could recognize a Stranger and Sons ad, you know, tasting of hundreds. We also got the IWSC award for a double gold, which is like a kind of like a little bit like our Oscars for the alcohol space. And it's the first time an Indian gin has got that size. It got that prize. And these are things that we never anticipated. Like, I think it's just, you know, this coming to your second question about like, what do people need? And I tell a lot of, I give a enough, Gyan sometimes, and the idea is that I think the back end of any business starts to look the same after a certain point. You know, your domain experience in the product will start to get left to other people, because you will have to go back to do the same thing, like figuring out whether your cash flows are in place and your people are happy and your business is on track and it's hitting its larger goals and it's growing more and you're firefighting. I think for an entrepreneur, your life becomes the same. I think if I talk to a guy that runs a chartered accountancy firm, or he runs a hospital, or we have a lot more things in common. I think when it comes to that product and passion about the product, that can only be done by you, like in this stage, like, right? Like, we built it, we stand behind it, we understand it. But at that point, I think it's up to you to give. Like, our product, from everything, like every single thing has been debated. If you see the cork, if you see how the wraparound comes out, there's a level of passion gone into the build. And I think that should be there, whether you're constructing a building or a bottle. You know, I think, understanding flavor and all understanding flavor and exposing yourself to the right spaces always matters. But I think when you're building that product, whatever product that is, just give it your 100% and stand by.
Yeah, I've never tried the Stranger and Sons gins. Also, I'm not a big gin drinker.
How long have you been?
Had a few gimlets in my life, but I'm very curious to. I've been here 5 days now.
And you're staying in Anjuna?
Yeah.
Wow, I really need to talk to my team, huh?
But I've had Stranger and Sons in Bombay, though, so don't worry about it too much. Okay. I've had it many times.
No, but I'm going to make it a point to, I'm actually, I'm obviously curious about the gin itself, but the way you described the thought that got into the, you know, the overall build, that also is something that I'm curious about. And I'm very curious to talk to you about marketing, but before we go there, I have a quick sort of nerdy question.
Sure.
In terms of licenses, what does it take in India to come up with something like that, where, you know, the going narrative is alcohol businesses are extremely tough when it comes to licensing and stuff like that. Every state has a different licensing requirement. Manufacturing, I'm assuming, it's even more complicated. So take me, if you could just throw some light on the licensing process of setting something like this.
I think the question, see, India is a bureaucratic red tape led state, as a nation. I think whichever industry you choose, you know, I talk a lot about entrepreneurial agility to like entrepreneurial agility, which I think Indians have a lot. You know, Indians are very, very good at adapting to situations very fast. You know, it's the land of the entrepreneur. From your small Kinara store guy to somebody who's just got the next unicorn. You know, like, I think it's got a huge ecosystem of people that do their own thing. And I think for whatever that challenge is, because you're in this territory, you are dealing with your own set of that kind of paperwork. And that's basically what it is, right? It's a government office that changes from state to state that has different laws. Our business is not the only one that deals with it. You know, there's pharmaceuticals, there's oil, there is anything, there's construction. Like the local and national in India has a massive disconnect for everything. So what I tell a lot, it's something that you have to basically take into your stride. I think when we looked at it, yes, it is slightly paperwork heavy. Yes, it is a taxable commodity. And that's how it works. It's built into our systems. It's built into our market structures. It's built, you know, and I think you just move on with it. I wouldn't give it a scarier figure than anything that anybody else is dealing with.
Got it. Fair. That's a refreshing perspective. I like the way you put it, right? It's the business that you got in, and just be prepared for it. It's not like it's a surprise.
Yeah.
Everything's out there on what's needed. You just have to follow the process and probably takes a little longer because of the bureaucracy, but it gets done.
Yeah.
That's a fair point. So I'm very curious about the marketing side of things. From where, what I understand, as you pointed out, 1% of India drinks gin, or at least that's when you started out, 1% of India drank gin. The idea is obviously to increase that share. And unless there's a good product out there, you can't really develop taste for gin, right? So you did your bit of creating that product, but the regulations don't really allow you to go out and outright market alcohol, right? So how do you take this brand, Stranger and Sons, and create that marketing and branding around it for people to know, hey, there's a gin brand and I should give it a shot and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One, India is not the only country that has banned this kind of marketing, right? It exists in many other states, and businesses thrive everywhere in the world. I think in general, India is constantly yearning for something new. It's a very exposed sort of young diaspora, which all of us are a part of. We have massive exposure on our digital platforms to everything that's happening all across the world, but have very little access to them. And then again, this comes, this India wave of people doing amazing stuff in India, and hopefully, you know, trudging that route of trying to get their distribution to as many people as possible. So I think there's a couple of things when it comes to building your customer, which is your final consumer, which you have to think about slightly more deeply. You know, in Third Eye Distillery always said that we will deal with premium. That's it. That's, we are in the premium category, and we will always launch products in the premium category. We got very clear very fast. We're not looking for anything above premium, and we're not really looking for anything below. So, you know, at no point will you see us trying to hammer down into thousands of stores at any point in time. The idea is, I think, for us was to constantly pick your partner, understand where your customer is. So pick a good partner, understand where your customer is, and then do what's necessary to tell the customer that you've arrived. You know, we the first lot for our launches in Singapore and Bombay and London, we chose this storytelling form of opening party, which usually happens for trade, which is like bartenders and restaurant owners. So that's the customer that's actually going to buy it. And then how do you make the brand interesting enough for the consumer that's eventually going to ask for it? Those are the two things. I think we basically took our target audience and really defined it. And then after that, basically just went after that target audience. So are we showing up with the correct surrogate brands? Are we showing up, you know, are we throwing our parties at the right venues? Are the right people coming to it? And by right, I mean, there's no right and wrong. There's right for RTG, right? So that's what I mean by right. I'm not talking about any sort of socioeconomic or any sort of strata of human being. And that's what we did. So we create strategies where we go to where we can get to our target market sort of closest, and from them sort of trickle down further to other places where they might you know, want to consume us. So at the moment, like, we're only available in Bombay and Pune. And we've just opened Delhi, and now we're just going to open Bangalore. But whether that was slightly delayed by COVID or, and that was kind of done on purpose, was to really understood that the latent demand that has been created in a city like Bangalore is now worth us paying for the amount of money that the distribution there would require. This is like an example, but it basically trickled out of Bombay, right? Slowly, obviously, we were also funds had to grow gradually. But the idea was to just hammer down, I think for us, what we've done is, and the brand is complex. Like, once the idea of creating a complex, like, complex brand is that, you know, you can keep, like, if you eventually do land up buying that bottle, look at the label. And if you spend enough time on the label, you'll keep finding stuff in it. And that was done on purpose. And that's how the brand goes, you know, like, when we give you a cocktail, or one of our recommended cocktails is a Gibson. The idea is a Gibson is basically a martini with a pickled onion in it. But let's take that concept and make it Stranger and Sons. India has a humongous pickling heritage, right? All of us have pickles at home. We understand what it's like to make a young pickle, make a vinegar out of it. That makes it fun for bartenders. They can go home and do it. They can make fun for consumers. They can go home and do it. So during the lockdown, we were doing these, like, sort of pickling masterclasses with people in, like, Jaipur, you know. And you can come back, make your own pickle, make it your own, make a stunning martini out of it, and we'll tell you all the other steps, and then serve it to somebody, or serve it at a party, or serve it to your wife, and you know what you know, your partner, and make elevate that experience, because Stranger and Sons was there for you, telling you how to do it. And that's the kind of stuff that we go for. We also then have something called a character called Fernando Fernandez, that embodies the Gibson man. He's basically still finding out his sexuality, but has inherited this, like, huge property in Goa that's full of making fruits. And basically, when every time he pickles this fruit, because he's like this Gatsby of Goa and has these massive parties. And when you come to one of our trade shows, we will actually have Fernando Fernandez standing there in the flesh, a trained actor that we worked with, his living room constructed for you, and he will serve you the Gibson. But that, you see, that embodied that story of Stranger and Sons, and you created a lovely memory with it. And our target market will understand that because of the work that it requires. If I had to do this at a mass level party with 10,000 people, so that would have been a misfire. So you have to understand what that is for yourself and how much you want to build.
Yeah. So from what I hear, from a marketing perspective, I think one of the things that you did, and it was non-negotiable for you, was identified that target segment and said, we just focus on this, while the other segments might be tempting, might be more volume, all of that. Don't care. This is what we focus on, and this is what we, this is who we are going to target in terms of the marketing activities that we do. And there's obviously co-branding and events that you have to do with the trade bodies or trade partners who are going to take your gin to the end consumer. One of the other things that obviously I hear, and this is very strong, is the storytelling and the branding aspect of Stranger and Sons, and how much thought process that's gone behind creating these stories behind the brand. I think that's extremely fascinating. I'm curious about the distribution channel for not just Stranger and Sons, but generally craft alcohol or craft spirits. What I understand from now, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's obviously a manufacturer like a Third Eye Distillery who's manufacturing all of these alcohol. What next? How do you take it to the cities? There are two channels from what I understand. There's obviously the restaurants and bars, and there's the end consumer, which is, you know, alcohol selling points where you can, just alcohol shops where you can go buy Stranger and Sons, right? What's the distribution channel? Are there middlemen in between that? Are there wholesalers? Are there agents who take you to restaurants? What's it like?
So the good thing, actually, at least for us, the great thing that we've noticed coming, at least being in FMCG before this and moving on to the alcohol space, is that the whole supply chain is pretty structured, because the tax payments have to be made at each level, which it's like a good and a bad thing. But it basically makes sure that everything is, you know, alcohol has to move from what is a bonded warehouse to a bonded warehouse. So you need a license for that. The license, you have to pay the dues for that. Everything has to happen on time. So everybody has to get paid on time. And it's actually a pretty good check and balance in at least the states we've operated in. So it's basically pretty simple. It goes from you. We are the manufacturer, from the manufacturer to a distributor, from a distributor to a retailer. From the distributor point, it can either go to a retailer or either go to a bar. The bar will then cut that up into different glasses, drinks, cocktails that we work on with the on-trade. We have somebody called Demi Lizinska on board, who is the ex-global brand ambassador for Grey Goose, who joined us really early on. Was as an advisor, now he's come on board full-time, and he runs our brand ambassador team, which is a set of very talented bartenders and presenters that will keep this on-trade active and keep us relevant. And for retail, then it goes into your standard retail channels. In standard retail channels, it's actually quite restrictive in the sense you can't actually anymore even have any banners or anything outside that basically pulls you towards the bottle. So the idea always is to, people will experiment at a restaurant, and then the idea is to then, or a bar, and then for them to go home and purchase it. Funnily enough, though, for Stranger & Sons, most craft brands will have, say, like 70% of their sales come from what we call the on-trade, which is restaurants and bars, and then 30% from off-trade, and you'll see that become closer to 50-50 if you're lucky over the years. We have stayed on the other side of that, so we are at 60% on off-trade and 40% on-trade, which is also something that we are trying to understand, but it looks like more people are buying Stranger & Sons for their house at the moment, which is a great sign.
Fantastic. I'm assuming the... correct me if I'm wrong, I'm assuming that's more margins for you as a business also, right?
Yeah, in the sense there's more, it's not more margins. I think the margin structure is the same. It's like a less marketing spends for sure. But it's not like we shy away from our spends.
Yeah. No, I guess, I mean, it's still, you're so early in the game that even if it's coming from the consumer side, you want to keep developing the on-trade side, because that's where you get the new consumers, right? So.
Yeah, and it's on-trade is where the excitement is, right? Without your restaurants and bars, and this is what COVID has seen down the line, they are that one place in which you can curate that experience for your customer. It's where all the real front end work is, right? Like, it's where you're interacting with that final customer. It's where you can make them a cocktail. It's where you can interact with a really cool chef. We just did, I don't know if you saw our first limited edition release.
I did. Peri Road Peru,
which is...
Yeah, Peri Road Peru with Bombay Canteen, right?
With the Bombay Canteen, right? So you can do something as interesting that, which is 100%, decided in their bar. How do you bring that back to the distillery? 100% natural guava extraction, which we've done with real fruits, balance it in a cocktail, send it out, get the tasting from the front. This was a really fun breakup of what we would have done pre-COVID. And it was, again, so far decently received. We ran out of stock faster than anticipated. Again, we really need to stop underestimating ourselves, I think, sometime. But I mean, again, so touch wood, some of the right problems to have at the moment. But exciting. This is how the serious trade structure is for India or export. Export, we usually have channel partners, so people who will do a pseudo job between marketing and trade. But as Stranger & Sons, we usually invest in each market. We don't actually just send pallets to markets. We run an entire investment program with that market. How are we going to build it? Who are we going to build it with? We're almost as involved.
So I would think by now it's a playbook of activating a new region or a country or a city, right?
Kind of. But the good thing about being nimble and a small company like us is that you can really hear what that market is saying. So like, we've just hired like our team in Thailand, and the whole idea was that the team there should be able to speak Thai. And then how do you convert your marketing spiels into languages that you don't understand and make sure it's being said correctly?
Those are
some of the new challenges that we're dealing with, but that's how deep we will go into it. They will present to me in Thai also, and I will have find a way to understand that. And you need a little village to basically get a product or a brand out, right? And the entire Stranger & Sons village is, or the Third Eye Distillery village is touch wood, quite finicky about how the brand is portrayed and how the liquid comes out and how your final experience is, which is great.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things, right? When you go premium, you also have the room to be more detailed oriented, right? If you go mass, pricing becomes a huge sort of factor in the demand that you're going to get. And if you're going to be focusing on the cutting cost aspects of making it as affordable as possible. Unfortunately, you can't focus on a lot of these things, right? So that goes well with the strategy of picking the target segment and then doing justice to serve that target segment.
Fernando Fernandez will not take anything less than perfection.
Yes, Fernando Fernandez will not.
From an export perspective, do you need licenses in India also to export, or is it the destination country where you need more of the licensing?
Obviously, like any country is much happier when you're exporting. The major licenses come on the other side, usually. You have licensed import-exporters here, which has been an age-old business for India. And so it's pretty set in its ways, and it understands it's not a difficult hurdle to cross. Yes, entering into some nations on the other side can be something that you need to understand. But again, it's something that you have to wrap your... Like, people all over the world are exporting alcohol, right? Like, it's happening somewhere. And it's not rocket science, that why so many people won't be doing it. So it's really about, I think, the attitude you take towards it.
I have a slight question on the distribution side of things, sorry. So you guys have done a lot of product innovation, but from what I can hear, you guys are pretty much following the same distribution route that companies before you have tread. So we were talking to somebody from the beer industry, and for the beer industry, because of the pandemic, they were allowed to set up growler stations.
Yeah.
So I don't know if, has there been any innovation in the entire distribution of craft spirits, or you guys still have to go through the wine shop route or the everything else?
I think for beer, and only in Maharashtra, if I'm not mistaken, is where they've allowed these growler stations and deliveries. I think Maharashtra has been easier than most other states on deliveries from restaurants and stuff as well. And I think it's a handful of states across the country that have done it. But yeah, I'm not the best guy for regulation. It's very hard. That's what I said. To be able to, from a beer license, I think is slightly different from a spirits license. And it's very hard to break that bond-to-bond transfer. You could by buying your own, but then the kind of money invested suddenly starts to skyrocket. And therefore, it's a very, you know, understand that the business on its own is actually quite driven towards volumes. So it doesn't really make sense for you to get a warehousing license for Maharashtra, because it's so expensive that it's geared towards you doing thousands of bottles.
Right.
So just from a pure theoretical point of view, please correct me if I'm completely wrong, is if Stranger and Sons wanted to do a direct to consumer model, they would have to have a bonded warehouse in Bombay, maybe, and from that bonded warehouse in Bombay, then they would deliver to the customer's place. Purely theoretical.
Not even the customer's place. Then I'll have to have a retail license on top of that. So I'll have to transfer to the... I have to get a retail shop and a bonded warehouse. Both licenses are separate. And then from there...
And retail shop in every single city that you transfer, that you sell to your consumer, basically, right?
Yeah. So get the state license for every single city. Yeah.
Right now, is there a way for somebody sitting in, let's say, Indore, because that's where I'm, if I'm not in Goa. Is there any way for somebody sitting in Indore to order Stranger and Sons and the bottle to come there somehow? Is that not the distribution channel doesn't permit that?
No. I mean, as usual, right? So even if you talk, the states has a very similar model. When you have federal laws and federal systems in a country, they're obviously going to protect the taxation of that state. So in India, it's considered, we actually have to write for export only from Goa to Maharashtra, because technically in our state's terms, it is getting exported from the state of Goa into the state of Maharashtra. The same way, so there is a import fee that goes into that movement. So, which is not an unfair thing to do.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, makes sense. I also have another sort of slightly nerdy question on the working capital requirements from I've dealt with a few FMCG clients when I was doing SME lending, and one of the things that I found out was, if you were a newer brand, you basically have to finance the distributors, which is basically your capital block till the product gets sold, which could be 60 days, 90 days, and in India 90 means 120. What's it like in the alcohol industry? Does the distributor I have no idea what the sound is, but yeah, so in the alcohol industry, do you have to finance that as a young brand, the entire supply chain, or the distributors are the ones who who finance that working capital requirement?
It really depends on the strength of your brand. But initially, there's no way around it. Same thing, being in FMCG, 90 days becomes 120. But what we've seen so far, at least in the alcohol space, is that that doesn't happen a lot here. It's only, because of this transfer and check and transfer of taxes and a lot of the larger five companies, creating most people's volumes and therefore demanding their money on time. And so the processes are quite set. Working capital for, I think, any sort of brand-based manufacturing startup in India, if they are not accounting for either a working capital debacle or a huge hole in your working capital for the first year, you are seriously misguided. You have to find that money. Yes.
Yeah. FMCG is one segment, but this is prevalent in most B2B businesses in India where people underestimate the impact of working capital. They think of it as, hey, I sold and therefore everything is good. But when the money hits your bank, it's actually more pain than in certain industries of India. Just collecting that money is more difficult than selling the product.
Yeah, I was there, man, doing it for 3 years. Like, I used to have a collection team, one of our boys, bars are what, 60, 70 bucks? Like, imagine collecting that much. It's nuts.
Yeah, it's crazy.
In my industry, my main job, people always ask us if we are making money from podcasting, but we don't. In my main job, there are some companies in my industry that have more than 200 days of receivables. Because these are companies that work with government or that work with companies that work with the government. So government payments are super slow sometimes. And you have 200, 250 days of working capital blocked or of receivables that are just blocked.
Yeah.
So that can kill a lot of companies. But anyway, going back to alcohol.
I mean, that also makes sense when you said, hey, we are in Bombay, Pune, now in Delhi, because you just can't go big in one go because of the working capital requirements are also pretty high. But just entering these industries, these regions and selling is not going to help if you can't, keep satisfying the repeat demand that comes from these cities.
Yeah, so the idea is to concentrate on what we call is sales stickiness. And also, I learned that really the hard way at Gauri's where, we really had to go through the rigor of being completely bootstrapped and saving that everything that would come and then trying to extend your creditors and then you suddenly go into this like loophole which you then have to like get yourself out of, which we realized pretty quickly here. And the whole idea was to really create sort of sales stickiness. So we want repeat buys and that's it. That's all we look for.
So I want to zoom out now to the craft spirits industry in general. And I don't know if you have other products in pipeline that you want to speak about from Third Eye Distillery perspective.
My marketing team will hang me upside down.
Cool. So we'll skip that. I'm just going to skip that question.
In the fear of my team, I'm going to not.
Yeah, fair. I'm just going to skip that question. Okay. From a craft spirit industry, I think before this, when I was researching and what's going to happen and all of that, I was fairly narrow in how I was thinking about it. But now that you mentioned the fact that a premium customer segment is what you're targeting. And if that's the segment, why are you just limited to India, right? Why can't you export to London and Singapore and Thailand and all these places? Which makes me believe that that's where the craft spirit industry in India is going to move towards, that it's going to serve the 1-3% of India that has an affinity to these products and are likely to spend that kind of money. But there's a huge market that's outside where you can take these stories, take these products, finely crafted products, and sell it to the world, right? Is that what you see happening more and more in the next few years?
I think that's a two-part question. I don't agree with you that the India market is only those 1-3%. The real crux of the India market is the aspirational market, and if somebody can crack that to a Western alternative or to a better local alternative, whichever way you want to look at it, I mean, that's a huge market in itself. So to stick to premium, we're already present in all the markets that you mentioned, right? Singapore, Thailand, UK. And yes, I think India is trending as a place, a new place of origin for people to figure out spirits. Some place that was never seen as a place that would make stuff that looks like what's coming out of the new brands. So often we Indians ask us, like, Stranger and Sons can't be made in India. It doesn't look like it. And that's like, that's more hurtful for me to hear than the other way around. That you should be able to believe that we can make a product that looks like this, or that any of the other guys are doing. I think the idea to stick to premium was, for us, was just because we understand that space better, we appreciate that space better, and the space allows us for more play, which drives us as a company and us as people to constantly be able to experiment, to constantly be relevant, to add social consciousness to everything we do, and then speak to the person that's at the moment, for a smaller company like us, something, a communication standard that we understand. Abroad, I think it's a little different in the sense that people are happy to hear about India, but India doesn't obviously have the best reputation for whatever reasons. But I think that's slowly changing. I think Indians are changing that very fast, especially this contemporary Indian that we're talking to. Is in general, I think people are becoming far more conscious about what kind of people they portray when they go abroad, and we're part of that wave. So I think the market exists is market to market. So I think Thailand is a far more growth heavy market, whereas Singapore, the UK are big platform markets for us. The UK is the capital of the cocktail capital of the world. So if you're listed in some of the best bars in the UK, which we are, it gives the product a lot of cred to stand on, which is what we were after. But India is the most roaring market for the alcohol beverage space, I think, in the world at the moment. Pre-COVID, post-COVID, we'll see.
Yeah. Those are two different worlds altogether, pre-COVID, post-COVID. We avoid asking that question per se because, one, the content's not timeless. Second, it's just a lot of heartbreaking stories on the plans that businesses had and how COVID changed those plans, right? It's more depressing and there's sympathy. But you guys seem to be doing really well. I was going to touch upon the limited edition that you... that you created with Bombay Canteen, fantastic sort of marketing behind it that gets you very curious about, like, oh, what is this? And like, what's the story behind this, right? And that took me in reading a lot more about how you guys were building these and stuff like that. Before we wrap it up, Vidur, I have a question on which bar do we go to in Goa to try some fantastic Stranger and Sons cocktails?
Oh, don't put me in that spot. I think Goa as a culinary spot is definitely like the next biggest hotspot, especially what we've seen what's happened after COVID. I think there's just the number of sort of almost like really good institutions that have now come up in terms of food and drink are surprising and pleasantly surprising at the moment. You should find a bottle of Stranger and Sons in almost any of these places.
So one question that we always ask our guests is, if you had to recommend some content for somebody to learn something more about your industry,
like craft spirits in general, actually.
Yeah. For craft spirits in general. Is there some content that would be podcasts or videos or books that you would recommend to somebody to learn more about craft alcohol, craft gin in particular, maybe?
I think a lot of the craft spaces globally are doing a lot of really fun stuff. And the great thing about Instagram is that you can just, follow who you want to. Yeah, so I mean, the most interesting brands or brands that you're interested in, especially their Instagrams are usually popping with, something or the other. St. George, Empirical Spirits, these are all the more exciting guys that are spending more time with their consumers. I think St. George has a monthly podcast or a monthly video, which is quite long. Empirical does one as well. I think in India, there's a lady called Priyanka Bla, something called The Dramatic, which is this podcast that's coming together, that's bringing industry folk in Southeast Asia and the rest of the world. And, you know, just talking about stuff they're dealing with and the relevance, which is a good one, which is based from India. The drinks fraternity is quite close to each other. There's, I think, also the Sidecar, which is one of India's best bars. I think even the team there, Yang Dup, they do a podcast on the industry and what's going on. So there's, I mean, it's a very involved industry and culture. It's not that large at the moment. So,
yeah, thank you so much for joining us today, Vidur. Thank you so much for, you know, sharing the journey of building Stranger and Sons and the kind of thought that goes behind everything that you guys do, from packaging, from branding, to the actual product development. It was very fascinating to hear. I am definitely going to go try some gin while I'm in Goa, because I'll have to wait till you guys come to Indore. If you ever do.
This has been the longest sales pitch of my life, guys, for one bottle.
No, I'll make sure it's more than one bottle. I'll make sure I make all my friends get it. I'll make sure everybody around me at least gets a bottle. I'm very curious, to be very honest, the way you describe the whole packaging aspect and that sort of definitely got my attention.
But Vidur, big question is Indore the kind of place that Fernando Fernandez will go?
Yes. So, by the way, we were looking at Indore pretty seriously from the start only. I think Indore has a great sort of contemporary culture and like a budding target market of ours, which, yeah, okay, fine. Bar culture is going to take some time to come, but it's not like it's not on its way there. But again, man, the idea is that, you know, how many markets can you go? So our process with
correct. You have to prioritize there and you have to focus on the bigger markets where with more potential.
Yeah, but like we are battling with Indore is definitely up there in the growth trajectory. One of the things we decided to do during COVID is to flip our strategy to looking at some of these domestic cities far more seriously. And, you know, everyone knows Bombay, Pune, Delhi, Bangalore, Hyderabad, okay ho gaya. Chennai, but you know, there are a whole bunch of these. Indore is definitely up there, man.